Radio Influence. The future is now.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a very special Monday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums.
And we are thrilled to be joined by Joe Flynn, General Michael Flynn's amazing and supportive brother. And thanks for being here with us today, Joe.
Tracy and Frank, thanks for having me. Really great to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, we've tweeted each other back and forth for a significant number of months now.
Yeah, I know. I've been following you for a long time. Love your stuff.
You know what's funny? I got to tell you, my sister made this box for me of like all these tweets and stuff from when I was like little all the way for my birthday. And yours is like in the center of the box, like blown up.
All right. That's great. That's great to hear. No, listen. I didn't really get active on Twitter until we opened the Legal Defense Fund because we were just, you know, it's the last thing I really wanted to do is become a personality or whatever, have a bunch of followers on Twitter and stuff. But it's interesting how once you get going with it, it's sort of, especially if you're tuned into what's going on in the world, it's sort of like this, it just sort of takes on a life of its own, right?
Absolutely. I have a couple really interesting questions for you I don't think you've been asked before.
Go right ahead. I'm having a little cofefe here and early on the West Coast.
I can't wait for these questions either.
Go ahead. I'm ready.
All right. So, you know, it's been said a bunch of times that General Flynn's politics actually were Democrat.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And so I was just curious about you.
Yeah, I was a Democrat. I was probably, of my brothers and sisters, and, you know, there's nine of us, I was probably the farthest left of all of them in the sense of just ideology. I mean, I was a Democrat for, gosh, the better part of 20, 25 years. We grew up in a, you know, in the Northeast in Rhode Island. My mom was an active fundraiser for a number of candidates back in the 70s and 80s, especially governors in the state. And actually, she ran for Senate. Early 80s or so, but it was a little bit different. I mean, obviously we were a military family that was a Democratic family. You know, we were Catholics, and my mom was also, interestingly enough, she was the head of a very big pro-life movement in New England while she was a Democrat, an active member of the Democratic Party. And so it's a little different in the sense of, like, you know, it's kind of like a Northeast Republican back in those days was kind of a liberal, a Northeast Democrat, especially kind of blue collar Irish Catholics. You know, they were Democrats, but they were very pro-military and very pro, you know, pro-America, really. And so that's how we grew up, and that stayed with us for a while, you know.
And that's fine. I mean, I think that's what it used to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we were working class families. We were Kennedy Democrats. We were obviously, you know, being Irish. You know, and we grew up in a town where everybody had a picture of the Pope and John Kennedy in their house, right? Mm. That's just the way we grew up. And that stayed with us for a long time. But, you know, then we saw that. I mean, we all saw the shift sort of towards the end of the 90s. It was palpable how far left, really, Hillary Clinton's ilk was taking the party. And then when Obama was elected, kind of all, you know, the wheels came off, right?
So
that's what happened.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. Like, I think it's pretty awesome. When did I don't even know that you are necessarily what you'd call a Republican, and we don't really even.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. So what is your political? But like, what is your?
Yeah, I kind of am I kind of look at President Trump, and I don't agree with everything that the president says or does, but I kind of like his pragmatic view of the world. What makes common sense is what I like. Okay. It makes common sense to have a secure border. Okay. It makes common sense to have a rational immigration system. It makes very common sense to have a strong U.S. military. Okay. That makes, to me, a lot of common sense. And so I guess I look at it like, you know, what makes sense that's going to push the country forward versus mire us in divisiveness. And divisive rhetoric that, you know, that doesn't solve any problems that the country has. We have a lot of problems. We have a lot of good things, but we have a lot of problems. We have you know, infrastructure issues. We've got some problems with the education system. So I don't know. I guess I look at it that way. And that's why I was attracted to Trump, even though, you know, I was never a really big fan of his, you know, when he was a personality celebrity. I didn't really pay much attention to him then, but I kind of was attracted to his message of sort of, you know, kind of radical pragmatism, I guess is the best way to describe it. And I think he's been true to his word through that. And so that to me is attractive. Personalities and all the other stuff aside, I really liked his approach to the issues, you know?
Great. So. Awesome.
Isn't it crazy how being pragmatic is radical these days?
Yeah.
And Mr. Flynn, what you had brought up before, I think is that's the way I grew up in the 90s. So I was being raised by all those Kennedy Democrats. Yeah. And right. That was the main thing. It was when I ever said, well, what's the difference between the two? I never got really an answer from anybody, and I had to figure out the minutia as I grew up, but it was common people, common sense. And right. if you look at what it was really stood by a lot, and you brought up the border, especially if you are at the lower rung if you're lower middle class, you know exactly what you're competing with. And that's why immigration and the border was a great concern for a lot of working class people, regardless of race. And now it's, you know, there's definitely been a huge shift in that, and people have actually accepted their own demise in some way. They've convinced people to accept their own demise and wanting to have the borders open. It's crazy to see.
Yeah, and I think both parties are to blame for this too. I mean, the Democratic Party, you know, looked at immigration as a way to get more votes in places like Florida, big electoral vote states, which is a shameless way to promote kind of illegal immigration. And you know, the really Chamber of Commerce Country Club Republicans looked at immigration as cheap labor coming across the border. I mean, I've been in California 20 years and, you know, it's been flooded, with all this cheap labor, which has been to the demise of the working class in this country and the minority and the legal minorities in this country, primarily African-Americans whose cities have suffered dramatically up until recently. You know, the unemployment rate amongst African-American young males was terribly, terribly bad. And now the president and his policies, economic policies in particular, have really helped and boost that. But it's laid bare the problems that illegal immigration have caused. I mean, you know, you guys may be, I'm in my early 50s. And, you know, when we were kids, right, in the 80s, we were washing dishes and bussing tables and, you know, doing kind of hard jobs around my little town that I grew up. But you don't see that anymore. It's just flooded with cheap labor, the country. And it's I can't see how that's going to be good. It has nothing to do with race. You know, it just happens to be the majority of those folks are from Latin America. But, you know, they're very hard. Most of them are really hardworking people who are just looking for opportunities. But with the floodgates open like that, it's not a good thing for this country. And it's not a good thing for those people that have worked hard to try to get into this country. And I have a lot of friends that are immigrants from various countries that went through the legal process, and it's incredibly expensive, time consuming, and you have to have an enormous amount of patience to get legal status here. Right.
Yeah. I love that. I love your perspective. Yeah. I think you're just like the majority of Americans nowadays, which is a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Tracy? I think it's important perspective, because with everything that's been going on over the last couple of years and the news cycle regarding Mr. Flynn and his family, you would think that this was some kind of a political boondoggle here, where you have this republic, this right wing force, going up against an Obama administration, the right wing, but it's not. There's something else going on. It's apolitical when you really think about it.
I agree with you 100%.
Thanks for dissecting my question's reason.
Yeah, good question. No, it's a good question, because General Flynn, Michael was very open about the fact that he was a Democrat, that he was a registered Democrat. Now, when he was a military officer, specifically when you become a general officer, you're really not allowed to talk about your politics. And he didn't talk about his politics when he was in uniform. And when they put a star on you, I mean, it's verboten really to talk about. And I don't know if you know, we have another brother who's an active duty three star. Yeah,
I do. Congratulations on that.
Yeah. He just got promoted. Great, great guy. Really quiet guy. Really,
you know, you guys are a very interesting family because you're not afraid to speak your mind. You're not afraid to kind of embrace what some in the quote mainstream would consider conspiratorial. I think it's great to see people that are respected like you are take that and run with it, because I was just saying this morning that the value assigned to the others is it's not well placed. So I wanted to talk to you when General Flynn was in the Obama administration. We've read and researched and we know all about what he just didn't agree with the foreign policy.
Yeah.
He wasn't really allowed to talk to you about it then, but did you sense frustration?
Yeah, I mean, I remember being visiting him one time when he was at DIA. It was really about within about a year of his command. And we were sitting he was living in Fort McNair, which beautiful. Washington, D.C. has this military base right on the Potomac where a lot of the brass live. And it was Mike's quarters backed up to Potomac. We were sitting outside smoking a cigar, having a drink at night. And he was venting that night about the massive mess that he inherited at the DIA. Specifically, he inherited an organization that was basically built to fight the Soviet Union, and the world had changed and the institution hadn't changed. And so he was trying to, and he was brought in specifically by Leon Panetta, who really liked Mike when he was Secretary of Defense. And it was brought in to really, you know, kind of dismantle the DIA and blow it up. And then when he started to do it, you know, I don't know if you can call it the deep state or whoever, the entrenched bureaucracy really pushed back hard on him. And he was, you know, and he's a fighter. And so he kept, you know, the fight was like a knife fight on a daily basis. That was sort of how he described it to me. And specifically around at that time, you know, we were kind of pulling out of Iraq, or the Obama administration was talking about pulling out of Iraq. And he was seeing the formation of ISIS. At the time, it wasn't called ISIS. It was just a bunch of, you know, Sunni radicals that were taking over large swaths of land. And he was saying, hey, these guys are going to form a caliphate. And he was really predicting what became ISIS. And the Obama administration wanted to shut that narrative down because they wanted to say that, you know, it's OK to pull the troops out of Iraq quickly. And we won and we got bin Laden and all this kind of thing. And Mike was saying, in fact, this cancer has metastasized to the point where it's spreading throughout North Africa and so forth. That was number one. The second big issue that he had problems with the Obama administration was their treatment of Iran as some type of regime that we could, you know, deal with, that we could have an honest relationship with. And then Mike was saying, you know, these guys are the largest state sponsor of terror. Their fingerprints are everywhere, including supporting Al-Qaeda. And again, that was a narrative that they wanted to shut down. And he wasn't going to have any of that. And he got into a lot of problems, forcing his early resignation. And of course, as a soldier, when they tell you, you know, hey, you're done, well, then you submit your resignation and you're out. And then that really worried him, though, what he saw in there and the way that the Obama administration in particular, Susan Rice and Ben Rose and so forth, were really running the foreign policy. He said, number one, these people have an agenda. It's not a pro-America agenda. It's going to put us in more jeopardy, and I'm not going to stand for it. I'm going to keep talking about it. And so, you know, obviously on a 2-year command, a 3-year command, he only lasted 2 years. So that's the way it went.
And during the time that he was in, and thanks for that answer, by the way, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm trying to ask you quick questions because we're at 15 minutes already, Joe.
No, and you know, we keep going. I'm good. We can keep going.
I just want to sit here and talk to you for hours.
No problem.
All right, cool. So
I've had two cups now. I'm
so now you're really good to go.
I'm exactly. Free until noon. I'm free until noon. So.
So while he was in there, he went overseas and this meeting with Halper and all the stuff that happened over there. Was there anything, I don't know if you even know this stuff, so just tell me if you don't, but was there anything that he thought when he left there? Was he suspicious at all?
No, at that time he wasn't suspicious. You know, at that time he was part of the team, right? It's like, hey, you know, I've been appointed to this job. Now it's a little different with military guys that get appointed because they're, you know, they were already government people working for the U.S. government his entire career, right? So he's, you know, he gets invited to a lot of places as the head of the DIA. And he had already kind of made a name for himself prior to becoming head of the DIA through some publications that he made while he was in combat that were somewhat controversial about basically how screwed up the intelligence community is and how ineffective they were at gathering information for war fighters. And so he had a name for himself. And so academic circles and others, you know, they would invite him to speak in different places. And he was, you know, he was on the circuit, even, you know, in uniform because he had this name for himself. So, no, I don't think he was suspecting of anything when he went over there to London, to the I think it's the Cambridge Institute or something like that. When he was invited, he spoke, and it didn't really even surface, that whole issue and Halper and all that didn't even surface until it was reported in the media by crazy left-wing journalists that Mike Flynn could have had some type of relationship with this Russian graduate student over there. And he was like, what are you talking about? You know, this guy has been married to the same, he's been with the same woman since they were 15 years old. It's like, are you kidding me? And so that kind of blew him away. But what it did kind of point out, and I think now in hindsight, we know this, is that they were spying on him a long time ago.
Yep.
They had their eyes on Mike Flynn while he probably was still in uniform because of how vocal he was. And that's, now we're finding out that, you know, that was kind of commonplace with the Obama administration. Really?
Yeah. It seems FISA was where doled out like candy. And, you know, he came back and he reported that trip and he did everything the right way. It wasn't like it was hidden.
Well, that trip was when he was still in uniform. The other trip that was also supposedly controversial was when RT invited him to speak at their 10th anniversary gala, and they put him at a table next to Putin, right? And that's a big deal. And you're right about that. He reported that to the DIA prior to going and reported after. Not just reported. It wasn't just like, oh, you know, I'm going to go to Moscow. It was, let's get briefed. What do you guys want me to do for you while I'm
exactly.
there?
Exactly. He was working for the organization. I mean, yeah, it's asinine.
For the Department of Defense. I mean, who was his employer for 33 years, you know?
So I don't know, like, when all this goes down, you know, obviously he spent most of the campaign season on the trail with Trump and Mike, yes. You know, Jr. was there with him a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
He formed Flynn Intel Group as a
couple years prior, a couple of years just after he got out of the military. My mom died in 14, Christmas of 14. And Mike had out of uniform. I think it was like October. So a couple of months before mom died. And then, like in that winter of 15, he formed Flynn Intel Group. He had lots of people, and he was doing lots of things. He was speaking. He was on boards of companies. It was just very normal for a kind of a famous.
What you do?
Of course, why not? You know, I mean, you know, you get that opportunity. You're a private citizen, opportunity to make some money when you get out. Many thousands and thousands of military and, you know, government people do that. And so he started to do business. Yeah, And that's it. And he wrote a book at that time, too. So
he goes on the campaign trail and kind of leaves the business running itself in a way.
Yes, to a certain extent. Yes. He goes on the campaign trail. Simultaneously, the book comes out. And he was, it's interesting. You hear people like Clapper, who Mike worked for many years, who's, you know, just a backstabbing, I don't know if I can say this.
Freedom of speech is on this program. Curse okay. away.
Just a backstabbing scumbag. I don't know how else to say that. I've met General Clapper. He's a slime ball. Sorry,
Mr. Flynn, next time you have to insult somebody, just let me know what you want to say and I'll say it.
Okay. Anyway, so a lot of people, a lot of candidates were coming to Mike and asking him to be an advisor. Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz. And it's like, you know, I heard Clapper one time say, well, he was, you know, peddling himself to all these different candidates. No, no, no. They were coming to him. Trump campaign came to General Flynn, which is fine. And he met Trump and his family, I think, around March of 16, and was very impressed with them and had a good first meeting with Trump, which was going to be about a half an hour meeting that turned into like a 3-hour meeting. And they just bonded. I mean, they just really bonded. There was something about their personalities and their relationship. Two very different backgrounds. I mean, it couldn't be any different.
Yeah.
But they bonded and I got to the point where he was on the short list for vice president.
That's how much
he liked him.
Great. I mean, you know, my point in all of this is to get to what happened immediately after the election when they started with the special counsel and all of that.
Yeah. We know that for now, in hindsight, we know this, that they were absolutely somehow spying on probably a FISA. Okay. And they used the excuses of whatever supposed Russian contacts he had, which was total bullshit. Okay. And the fact that he had a contract with a company that wanted to promote the interests of the Turkish government. Now, that company was a private company, and they were focused on the recent coup in Turkey that had taken place in September of 16.
I feel like they threw that in as an afterthought, though.
They did. They did throw it in as afterthought. They threw it in as a way in which to force a plea deal, frankly, because they threatened, you know, well, they set him up in the White House. They targeted him, Sally Yates, Susan Rice. They targeted him. He's 24 days into the administration. They come in and they speak to him without warning. They set him up. Trump's forced to make him resign, or he has to resign because of this whole situation. And then the special counsel is announced, and then they use this whole Farah bullshit thing to force him into a plea deal because he's running out of money. And then they also threatened his son, who had just had a baby. I mean, the whole thing was just one, you know, misadventure after another.
That was my next question. Everybody wanted to know, why did he plea? And it was clear the Turkey nonsense was the only reason why he would. But a lot of people thought that he did it to expose other things.
He had already spent, by the time he pled guilty, he had already probably spent close to $700,000 in legal fees, okay? Which he didn't have. We didn't have a legal defense fund at the time. So it's like, you know, and so he was facing, you got to understand, people have to understand this. You know, I don't know how many people have $700,000 lying around, okay? But people have to understand, every time they call you, the government calls you in to testify, this was even before he pled, to have a conversation, to this, you're paying two lawyers thousands of dollars, you know, $1,000 an hour, maybe five lawyers, $1,000 an hour. And it's like, where am I going to go with this? And then his son was being forced to do the same thing. Son didn't have a pot to piss in. Okay. Had just had a baby. And Mike, like a lot of people say, well, shit, okay, I can't take this anymore. Let me plead guilty and this will go away.
Little did he know.
Little did we know. We're 3 years into this and it was publicly announced that, you know, we're $4.5 million in legal bills at this point. I can tell you it's well more than that. By the time it's over, it's going to be well more than $5 million, $6 million, God knows what. But the emotional strain that puts on people is, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't know how many people in your audience have that kind of money lying around.
Well, if they do, they can gladly hand it over to you.
That's true. We'll take it.
If they wanted to, where would they? Right. I have more questions, obviously, but if they wanted to, where would they go to give?
Yes, they would go to www.MikeFlynnDefenseFund.org.
I think, you know, everybody out there, we've talked about this story a lot on this podcast. Please help out General Flynn. I've made a couple donations myself, to be honest.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's fine. I think it's important. And, you know, when his attorney made the original attorneys, they made a statement, you know, Mike Flynn has a story to tell.
Yeah.
And everybody took that in a different way. Did that come directly from General Flynn or was that just a?
I mean, listen, I'm going to take a minute to throw them under the bus.
Okay, do it.
I mean, I had a lot of interactions with with Covington Burling, and most of them were negative. My sister and I, Barbara, who you see on Twitter from time to time, she's out there really great tweets and stuff. But we worked hard to build to create the Legal Defense Fund because, you know, Mike was number one, not really excited about looking to get donations for his legal defense, because it just is not easy to do that when you're a 3-star general, you know, and with the level of pride he had. But we told him, listen, you know, we got to do this. Otherwise they're going to sink you. They're going to destroy you completely. But we had to deal with Mike's lawyers, and we were always frustrated with their lack of open defense of him and his purse and his reputation. I mean, we went 2 years without those lawyers saying anything,
yeah,
or saying very cryptic things. And Barbara and I and others in my family were like, what the hell is wrong with these people? Every time the media would throw some bullshit story out there, you know, you would think that his lawyer would be on TV the next day calling bullshit on the story. But of course not. Kept his mouth shut, which I thought was a terrible tactic. And it put Mike in a bad position.
Why did he keep him for so long?
You know, it's a great question. You know, like anything, you keep thinking things are going to get better, or you keep thinking, okay, it's going to be over. I'll just get this behind me. And, you know, that didn't happen. I mean, so, you know, we're human. We all make mistakes and, you know, we all make mistakes. But that's when Sydney came into our lives.
Thank goodness. What did you think about the hearing for his, when
we were in shock? We were in shock. I mean, we thought we were going to be walking out of there, you know, with some type of small probation thing or something that he could get his life back together. And, you know, believe me, we had a lot of plans. He was about ready to go public with a lot of things and opportunities. And, you know, we were getting ready to start a new life. And the judge went berserk in that courtroom. And my theory of that is, first of all, I don't think the judge was read in very well on the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that the judge jumped to a lot of conclusions during the first part of the trial. During the first part of the hearing, that he then backtracked.
Yeah.
And said, oh shit, I didn't realize that, you know, he stopped.
What he did was so detrimental.
Well, it's terrible. It was terrible to the general's reputation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it was horrible.
And it was sick. It was bad. You know, obviously I got to be careful mm-hmm. talking about this judge because he's still head of sentencing, but you know, so it was, and actually I had invited Sydney to sit with us because I met Sydney and spent a lot of time with her at a conference September or so of 18. And got to know her pretty well over a couple of days, had dinner with her and so forth. And then I said, hey, when this, you know, I read her book and I said, when this trial comes down, you got to come to Washington and sit with us. You know, we'd like you to, because she had written about Judge Sullivan. He was a star.
He is.
In her book.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a star in her book. And so she was like, it was interesting. She came into it thinking, now this is going to be good. This is going to be good. And even she, afterwards, we went and had a drink down the street at the Dubliner from the courthouse. And kind of were staring at each other like, what the hell just happened? You know,
it was a shock to everyone watching, myself included. And, you know, what people are getting from this, and this is okay. I have to be careful how I ask this question. She's uncovering a lot of malfeasance here. Does any of this contribute to the possibility of things being changed around here in regards to the plea, or is he just going to accept guilt for the things that he, quote, did and move on?
I don't have any specifics, and Mike and Sydney are very careful.
Yeah.
Not to tip their hat, especially to me, because I speak in the media a lot, so they're not, you know.
They don't tell you anything you could ruin.
Yeah, they're not going to tell me anything because I got a big mouth. And I don't blame them because, you know, this is a high stakes, very, very high stakes situation, as you can imagine at this point. So all I can tell you is that he feels much more comfortable. He and Lori, his wife, feel much more comfortable with Sydney. We feel much more comfortable with Sydney. We know she's a hardworking, smart as hell, whip smart person who's experience with government, prosecutorial misconduct in particular, is vast. And so she knows all the games What was interesting in the last hearing, I was at the last hearing where she was introduced to the judge, and it was a completely different tone. This was back in June. The judge had a very different tone. In fact, he greeted her, and he sort of said, you know, in full disclosure to the court, you know, I'm in her book. I have a signed copy of it. I think it's a great book. It's nice to see you today, counsel. You know, it was like completely different. Whereas, you know, it was almost when in December, you know, it was almost like Sullivan was chastising both Mike's lawyers and he was chastising the government simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So the vibe was a little bit different. And what was important in June in that hearing when Sydney was presented as a new counsel was that she asked for security clearance so that she could get access to the classified information related to General Flynn's case. And the government was kind of like, well, there's no, you know, we don't really have any. And she said, I want it anyway, because she didn't believe them at all, because it's not true. Of course they have classified stuff, because it's clear that they had some type of warrant to spy on him or to surveil him.
There's no other way that they would have had any of the.
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. So I think she's going to get to the bottom of it. What direction it all goes, who knows? Like I mentioned earlier, it's high stakes. It's going to play out. It's going to take, you know, I think this is going to go well into the fall, unfortunately. Because I can tell you the one thing that really, when I talk to Mike, I talk to him a lot. The one thing that really he laments a lot is not being able to speak, because he's under, it's not really a gag order, but he's on what they call under protective order, meaning he can't speak mm-hmm. in order, and not to protect himself, but to protect the government. And so if he speaks in any way, shape, or form, then the government can, and he has a couple of times, and they came down on him pretty hard about speaking publicly. So he's really, really itching to do that. I can tell you that.
When he does, I'm curious. Like, you know, there have been a lot of rumors and things, I mean, listen, let's just be honest. Like, there's a lot of things that people think he knows that they want to hear him say.
Yeah, I mean, he knows a lot of things and stuff. Obviously, given his background and, you know, people that, you know, he's in contact with a lot of people. But, you know, that doesn't make his life, day-to-day life, easy, right?
I mean, No.
I mean, he cannot travel, so you understand. I mean, he sold his place down in Virginia, kept his place up in Rhode Island, but he can't travel 50 miles outside of Newport, Rhode Island, where he lives. I mean, can't even go to a Red Sox game in the summer, can't even drive to Boston, go to Fenway Park. You would think he's El Chapo or something, yeah. Right? This is crazy. Now, you know, and that's those are the kind of things. It's like, you know, shit, this is crazy.
You read, I'm going to let Frank jump in here because I've monopolized the half hour, but when you read basically the 302s that were released of when they were sent over to meet with him the first time, right?
Yeah.
You read them and you're like, this is just a nice guy.
Yeah.
Who is talking to a bunch of people he thinks are on his side.
Well, interestingly enough, this is an important anecdote. When Andy McCabe called Mike to have those two agents come over, he said he just has some, they had been over, the FBI had been in the White House a couple of days prior during the transition doing security related things, meaning physical security related things and so forth.
You mean bugging it?
No.
I'm just kidding.
Maybe. No, but like, you know, briefing people on issues, whatever. And so McCabe calls Mike and says, you know, it's just same kind of routine security stuff we were talking about over the past couple of weeks. So Mike's thinking, sure, two counterintelligence guys. He might even have known them. I don't think he did know them, though. But he might have heard their names because they were pretty high-ranking guys when he was in uniform. Oh, yeah, Peter Strzok. Oh, this guy, Joe Pienk. Oh, yeah, sure, I've seen their names somewhere, whatever. So he's thinking these guys are on our team.
Right.
You know, and they're FBI guys. And he has a lot of very, very close friends that are FBI guys. I can tell you that right now that he's worked with over the years. And they're still good friends with him. And so he's thinking, yeah, bring him on. It's no problem. We're all part of the same team. And then, you know, little did they know that this was an absolute setup. They were going to use Mike. They used Mike.
Yeah.
To start the entire special counsel. Absolutely planned, coordinated. Couldn't have gone better for them, by the way. They did. They're very good at being corrupt.
So the memos from Comey were like an afterthought, and you think that basically the what they did to your brother was kind of part of the plan to get the special counsel.
Sure. And the president was, it's interesting when the president told Comey, you know, go easy on Flynn. You know, he, you know, he's a good guy. I mean, remember, that's what he said, right?
Yep.
He didn't say you must go easy on Flynn. I command you to go easy on Flynn. So this bullshit about obstruction of justice around the mic, around the go easy on Flynn thing is exactly what it is. Absolute bullshit. Comey writes memos, confidential memos about a conversation with the president of the United States on a sensitive issue, and then leaks it to the New York Times. Well, and then they, and then Rod Rosenstein corrects, you know, with the help of Bob Mueller, creates a special counsel. I mean, it's so obvious that this was corrupt.
You know, Priebus asked him point blank in one of those memos if there was a FISA on General Flynn.
Yeah.
He asked him point blank. We don't get the answer.
Yeah, and I have, you know, that's a name that I'm, you know, I'm not a big fan of that guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, neither am I. And it's funny that you say that. Well, you know, you mentioned just now Rod Rosenstein in kind of a negative light, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there prior experience behind that, or is that new?
No, I don't. There was no relationship with Rosenstein. I just think Rosenstein, I mean, I just think that I'm not one of these guys that says Rosenstein's a great guy. The fact that he allowed that special counsel to take on a life of its own and broadened its scope without any kind of boundaries around that,
mm-hmm.
it shows you there had to be some kind of agenda there because there was no evidence of collusion with the Russians, and they knew it a long time ago.
Yep.
You know,
Rosenstein is like Varys from Game of Thrones to me.
Yeah.
He's there. He wants to be able to play along with as many people as he can so that no matter how this thing implodes, he can kind of increases chances of floating safely to shore at the end.
Well, you got to remember, these guys are thinking beyond, you know, 8 years of Donald Trump, right? They're thinking, you know, they're in Washington. They float between the government and these high powered law firms down there. And so they got, you know, Rosenstein's a fairly young guy still. He's looking out all for the next 15 years of his career, right? And what other things he can do. All of them are like that. A lot of people in Washington are like that. Trump and Flynn go into Washington to basically tear the place down because it needs to be torn down, or at least elements of it need to be torn down, you know?
Well, you know, that's something I wanted to bring up, Mr. Flynn, and that's Tracy had brought this up not too long ago about the theories that the public have had, and I have indulged in at least a half a dozen theories about what your brother was doing, what General Flynn has been up to as far as the pleas and what was going, was it purely to address personal concerns, or what did he also allow himself to be drawn into the belly of the beast in order to bring it down? Because I, from a public standpoint, this is what a lot of people are looking at. I don't know if your brother has picked this up along the way, but Americans have a real legitimate fear that a large, sinister faction within our government is working to destroy what is left of our civic culture and everything. We know how bad it's been for generations at this point, but a lot of people really do believe that we are breathing our last gasps as a former republic. And I think because we're so focused on the future right now, if this could happen to your brother, especially with his resume, the average citizen is absolutely powerless. Is there anything you can tell us about his?
I would say that he absolutely, one of the things that he was motivated and still very motivated about is exactly what you just mentioned. What he saw on the inside, in particular with the intelligence community, and to a certain extent, the Department of Justice, that they had become completely overrun by an element that was in cahoots with the media to fundamentally change the country and take it in a direction towards what I want to say is democratic socialism. He saw this. He's aware of it. It's one of the reasons why he joined the Trump campaign, and was one of the things he was going to do was really go after that, particularly on the intelligence and foreign policy side. I think he believes it still exists, that that infrastructure, bureaucratic infrastructure, deep state, whatever you want to call it, exists. And that, you know, the kind of that battle, internal battle, is still raging. And I think you see it recently with the appointment and then unappointment of Johnny Ratcliffe as the head of DNI. I mean, how in the hell can that happen in a 3-4 day period? You know, and what are they and how does somebody as strong as President Trump succumb to that? You know, there's something there that's very sinister that needs to be dealt with. And I think General Flynn is aware of that and is concerned. And I can tell you right now, not necessarily going to give up in that fight. So to the extent that I can give any insight into that, hopefully that gives you some insight.
Good enough. For me.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, he had the line that about digital soldiers, like that really motivated people to, you know, people look up to him. People respect him.
Yeah. He's reading all your stuff, by the way. He's reading all the digital soldiers that are out there. He reads them all.
You know, I've gotten so many messages from people saying, oh, my gosh, General Flynn DM'd me. And it makes people feel so involved and included and a part of the fight, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he, like I said, he's sitting there and he's reading everything and he's paying attention.
That's an honor.
He's paying attention.
He DM'd me.
That he could.
I think he's DM'd me too.
He's paying attention and is still incredibly concerned about things. And we talk about it all, you know, we as family, and obviously we're very close with each other. And we're talking this stuff. We're all pretty in tune to this. Obviously, you know, we still have five people in uniform.
Yeah.
Between our immediate sibling and our grandkids, we have four in uniform of the grandkids. You know, so we're still involved in this. Yeah,
and so we need to talk about this legal defense fund again.
Yes. Yes. Well, Tracy, thanks. And Frank, thanks for this. But yeah, so we have the Mike Flynn Legal Defense Fund. We are still in this war battle, however you want to call it, probably long war. It is incredibly helpful, any donation. And we are so grateful for the support we've had. I can tell you, without this fund, we would be in a lot more dire straits. But we still need funds. And the website is MikeFlynnDefenseFund.org. So that's MikeFlynnDefenseFund.org. The trustee, my sister Barbara Redgate Flynn, she manages it. We're careful with what we take in. We don't take any money from outside of the United States, nor do we take anything from the Trump organization or the Trump administration. But we'll take it from average citizens, and that has those average citizens out there and people like you, Tracy and Frank, that help us get the word out. We just greatly appreciate it.
Of course. And, you know, it's just an honor to speak with you, and your family's done so much for this country for decades now. Frank, you have one last question. If you could ask anything of our guest here.
Honestly, what I asked last was the biggest thing there. I mean, we're all following all of this and waiting with bated breath to see what's going on. I mean, all of the sentencing delays, we've been wondering what the mechanics behind all of this were and the intentions and the mission. Because we know that this is always going to be multi-layered. You guys are fighting a battle as a family. There's that. But at the same time, we know I was in talking to your nephew a little bit at the walkaway march and all that stuff. Yeah. I also know that the dedication and the commitment to that sense of duty to the American Republic is also there. So I know I that's always what I'm trying to figure out, is what the balance here between self-preservation and also trying to really stick it to the pockets of evil that have taken over our government and tried to destroy our civic life.
It's a tough balance. That's a tightrope, right? To walk. Because, you know, we still live in a situation where the justice system that's somewhat broken. And so, you know, I equate General Flynn as a political prisoner. He's a political prisoner. There's no other way to describe it, because if it wasn't for his politics or his views on the way the country should be going, he would not be in this situation. And nobody can tell me otherwise.
Nope.
Nobody could say, and people on the left would say, oh, well, he lied to the FBI, committed a felony. That's a bunch of bullshit. How many, you know, we know that that's not true. The Farah stuff is a bunch of bullshit. We know that that's not true. They targeted this guy because of his stance that he took on what was going on deep in the inside the government. And he's a political prisoner. And make no mistake about that to your listeners out there. General Flynn is probably the most prominent political prisoner this country may have ever had, or certainly since for a very long time. And that, sorry, I'm losing my voice.
That's okay.
That fact is going to come out. That fact is a true fact. And people want to realize it or not, when we get out of this kind of cloud of you know, being kind of suppressed, that fact is going to come out, and we're going to keep this fight. We're going to keep this fight. I'm going to take this fight to the next level because it's very important, very, very important. I mean, for all Americans, I mean, for liberals as well. I say this to people on the left, because I came from not really the left, but certainly from the Democratic Party. And that's why, Tracy, I love what you guys are doing with the walkaway movement. I'm so, so excited about that movement, because I think it's going to have a big impact on the elections going forward. So
thank you. Thanks. I'm honored to work on the board for Walkaway. I don't, yeah, you know, I just, if I want to say thank you for spending 47 minutes and 22 seconds with us today.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And I also want to just, if hey, General Flynn, if you're listening, I'm just but one of the independent journalists that are working to tell the truth about your story. And if the truth weren't on your side, I wouldn't be so passionate about this, but it is. And you're a good man. And we all thank you so much for the sacrifice. You too, Joe, and your family. And we're here for you guys, because good is there. You know what I'm saying?
Like, thank you. I agree.
If the story didn't lend itself to you being honorable people, I would be reporting something different.
Totally. Totally. And so, I appreciate that. I think, you know, hopefully, you know, our integrity speaks for itself and our honesty about stuff.
We don't
really pull a lot of punches. We're not looking for anything other than keeping this country strong and on the right track.
Well, God bless. And thanks for being here. Don't hang up yet. Okay. We're just going to pause real quick. And Joe Flynn, everyone.
Yes.
That was something.
That was a great way to start the week.
Yeah, certainly was.
Especially, you know, since how shitty the week ended.
You know, I decided yesterday that, like, even though I'm kind of like faking my Twitter pledge that I'm not going to talk about this anymore. I can't talk about these shootings, because we're not allowed to mourn the victims because of the political bullshit that's going on.
Yep.
We have to be on the defense.
Yeah, and
We're, you know, I will not allow this term white nationalist, whatever the F that means, to become the new KKK.
Well, the only thing is that the KKK was a physical presence in the country at one time. Thank you, Democrat Party. And it was something that you can actually account for. White nationalist is an internet creation. It's almost like Slenderman, where the left has willed it into existence, and the media reports on it, and it's almost as if they're giving constant coverage of the monsters under their bed or the monsters hiding in their closet. There are no men and women in white hoods running around the country. It is an internet creation.
It's you know, GRP said something really great. He said basically they're taking these words and morphing them. They're morphing the meaning of nationalism to be a negative, which they've been trying to do for years now.
Well, yeah. Well, they had no way to really go after Donald Trump in 2016, and we know that the divide between Democrat and Republican is very few and far between as it is. I mean, it's becoming more apparent that the Democrat Party is full on communist and Republican Party is a little bit more of a mixed bag of ideas in there. But we heard it in 2016 when they started coining the term alt-right.
Yeah.
Which if you listen to anybody try to identify it, it used to just be what we used to call racist in, just 10, 15 years ago. So they call it alt-right. And you're like, what the hell is it? The rise of the alt-right? So now there's all these things that are rising. There's no physical evidence of it, but there's things that are rising. And they're the ones that are going to be reporting and defining it. That's why I think that today's it was good to talk to Mr. Flynn here.
You're right, because I've got a list of topics, Frank, that we were talking about last week that now all of a sudden disappeared and it's not happening.
That's it. You see, now that's it. And I'm going to be spending a lot of time. That's all I'm going to be spending on time on tonight. All the things that have disappeared. You have the Congresswomen, the Stygian witches in Congress, gone. They were embarrassing the Democrat Party.
Ilhan Omar's brother marriage is gone. Cummings all is gone. Gone. Batowski Cummings. Is gone. Yep. You know,
Baltimore gone.
Yep.
Not only that, but 2 or 3 weeks of embarrassing Democrat debates gone.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that was going, not only the failure to answer basic questions and evading questions about communism and how you're going to pay for your horrible ideas, but just what they have all they stood for, raising your hand for pretty much providing all of the third world with health care based on the backs of the American taxpayer. Everything is gone. And on top of all that,
Papadopoulos and Halper, Comey.
Papadopoulos is gone. That's coming up soon. We know D-class is coming. And the other thing is that on top of all that negativity that was invading and occupying the world of the progressive left, Donald Trump and his rallies were nothing but seething positivity.
Yep. It's almost like.
Yeah, no, it is. It is almost like. And then on Friday, we have the FBI telling us warning about conspiracy theorists. And then we have a weekend full of shootings.
Using Snopes and Wikipedia as sources.
Yeah. And what do you know? They're all putting their manifestos on 8chan.
Of all places.
Not even 4chan.
8chan. 8chan, where Cloudflare has now decided they're not going to do DDoS protection anymore. And I just have to say that this Ohio shooter was all over Twitter, retweeting Right Wing Watch and all of that nonsense. And Twitter is still standing, the last I checked, saying how, you
know. Elizabeth Warren supporter.
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Warren should be ashamed of herself perpetuating hate like this. Absolutely ashamed.
Well, this is the advantage. This is the advantage of being on the left and having total disarmament of the public, no matter what country that this ideology rears its head in. This is the advantage of being on the left and having this as your ideology. Because if you're in office like Barack Obama was during Sandy Hook or anything like that, you're not going to get the blame, because after all, I don't want anybody to have guns. And when you're not in office, you can blame anybody who stands by civil liberties like self-defense as a agent of violence and an agent that actually empowers this kind of extremism. So that's it. And then if you go to heyjackass.org, you go to heyjackass.org, and that'll give you the weekend, the monthly, the yearly violence and gun death totals in Chicago alone.
I just tweeted an article today. You know, everybody's doing it, you know, tweeting articles about Chicago. But listen, what are the three things that don't fit the narrative in Chicago? They're no good. Some of the strictest gun laws in the country. A heavily African-American community that are slaughtering themselves to death. And Democrat leadership. So we hear nary a peep from any of those people. The same people that are clamoring over the deaths, the unfortunate deaths of these folks in El Paso. Coincidentally, a place where Antifa just recently said they'd be hanging out for some violence and targeting themselves. And they're championing, like they're lamenting the death of those people, while meanwhile there are millions of babies being killed prematurely every single day, and all of their compadres in Chicago and Baltimore and all the other violent cities all over the country being killed every single day. But they don't care about them. They only care about what's politically convenient, which is why these are soul-sucking, vapid, disgusting human beings.
Yeah, it's awful. It's as if it's not tragic enough that we're looking at this kind of loss of life. It's even more tragic that every last time a trigger is pulled in a fashion like this, it is a political event that is only, and they'll say, oh, this is not about having the upper hand, it's about just being human.
Yeah, yeah.
It is only beneficial to one group of people. So the fact that these are purely political events, these killings, makes the loss of life, it's almost as, you know, the Garlic Festival, I didn't even pay attention to it.
Well, it didn't fit the narrative.
I'm completely desensitized.
I know, because it turns into this. Why are we defending our, like I said to this morning, why are we even assigning any damn power to what they have to say?
Because they still have the multi-billion dollar funded foghorns that are the old media and Silicon Valley. You look at the trending topics on Twitter, the trending topics on Facebook. I'm sure that was probably amazing. I'm off of Facebook completely now. But I mean, that's what we're talking about here. The squeaky wheel gets the oil, and they are the squeakiest, even though they are the smallest. Year to date in Chicago, shot and killed 278, shot and wounded 1,364. Total people shot 1,642, and total homicides 305. That is in the gun control poster child city. Okay, and it is like that in every place that you put that that stencil over it. All of these Democrat-controlled gun control havens are the most violent, unlivable places on earth.
All I've got to say, Frank, is that these politicians that we, the people, put into office to protect our God-given rights had better, and even President Trump, you'd better be careful about what laws you sign in that have to do with gun control. Because he's signed some things that have been a little bit not okay to me. The bump stock, I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is what it is.
Are you going to grab your the nearest weapon and go out and shoot people, Frank?
No, you know what it is. I think that Democrat, well, they're so stupid, because what you have is you have these a situation in which this violence is allowed to brew. It's a tinderbox scenario. We saw it with Parkland in examining what is really the culture down there in Florida with crime statistics and reporting on crime statistics and all the federal money that is pumped into the school systems. If you can show that crime is going down, how children are being used by adult criminals to go out there and commit crimes. That's pretty much what Trayvon Martin was doing, because they know that they're not going to really, there's going to be a quota of how many arrests of children there could be. Not only that, you're seeing a society where, and most, if not all of these kids are coming from broken homes. They have drug problems. They are on prescription drugs.
Yeah.
And all of the common sense
gun control laws
and all that stuff, including the federal oversight and how you report problematic people to federal authorities. That's another common thread throughout all these shootings. Many of these shooters have slipped through the cracks of the systems that we set up so that we can catch them. The FBI, how many times was Nick Cruz reported to the FBI and they didn't follow up?
I know.
There's no accountability. Everything is nonsense. So it's for everybody out there who there are many of us that think, oh, MK Ultra, mind control, trigger words, this and that. But when you really think about it, the circumstances that we've created in society with the lack of accountability, the broken homes, our culture in disarray as it is.
God is gone. Or a higher power of some kind.
Yeah, the drugs and everything else. It's a tinderbox scenario. This society is going to breed this stuff. And then from there, it's just a matter of who is best equipped to jump on and steer the narrative. And we know that this is the wheelhouse. This is in the wheelhouse of the left, because ultimately they want everybody completely disarmed, not accounting the fact that there's over 100 million illegal firearms in the country, which would make all of us just fish in a barrel afterwards. But they don't care. They don't care. You look at the murder, the homicide rates in Central and South America that are doing all the same disarming. They would want that more often. I don't, but there's no talking to them.
It's not going to happen here. It's just not. It's not going to happen. They're not taking
it. It's just
them.
So sick to see people so weak. Twitter is so weak right now. Weak.
I had to try and stay off of it yesterday. I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, I wasn't on that much at all.
Plus, I got a lot of other stuff going on.
Well, listen, we had a great episode today.
Listen, Joe, listen, I want you guys to listen to some of the things he said more than once. There's a lot there. There's a lot there. You agree?
Yes. No, what? I sat back and I listened to a lot of it.
I know, I didn't let you talk.
Honestly, it's fine. I was really enjoying it.
Okay. Well, if you enjoyed it, then the people out there will too. And I'm sure he'll be back because he's really great. Really great guy. Honored to talk with him, have him on the show. You guys have been listening to the Dark Delight podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums.
And me, Beans. You guys can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2:30 Eastern Time on TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, and on RadioInfluence.com. Share this episode with your friends, guys, and make sure you go to, Mike Defun... I should probably know what it is, right? Hold on.
Yes.
You can go to MikeFlynnDefenseFund.org to contribute to the defense of this patriot. And we will see you on Wednesday.
Absolutely, you will.
This is a Landry Football Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Question before we get into tackling and more about the 3-4. Jacob asked about Cliff Kingsbury. He says, is it too simplistic to say that because Kingsbury had very limited success, was fired at Texas Tech, that it would be a huge surprise if he wins and doesn't get Kyler Murray killed? Here's the thing. The roster's not very good. They've got some work to do there. I don't think they're going to get Kyler Murray killed. I think that Cliff will certainly understand what you can do with Kyler, and while the run element's going to be there, but the hope, I think, is to be a much more athletic Russell Wilson that doesn't get hit, that gets out of bounds, that slides. If he doesn't, that's an issue. I don't see him getting killed. I don't see them being foolish enough to play it that way. What I see is obviously an offense that's built around Kyler. So what does that really look like? It's a lot of boots, a lot of rollouts. You will have to make some plays in the pocket. It's going to be a deeper set pocket to give him the opportunity to be able to see over the line, which is going to be much more difficult than in college. Guys are bigger. Guys are taller, offensively and defensively. I think there'll be a lot of half-field reads. It's quarterback-friendly. I think with the ability of him to be able to throw it on the move and the ability of the run threat is going to help them better identify coverages pre-snap. It will probably limit the man coverage that they're going to see. I think because of it, you're going to, again, people are going to try to stem their front and give them some different pre-snap looks. But I think it's going to be an easy adjustment because I don't think they're going to throw a lot at them.
The Landry Football Podcast with veteran scout and coach Chris Landry can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.